Ladies and gentlemen, it's a pleasure to be here. I should say that I'm an academic. I have a speech here that was written for 1 hour and I could use it for four. So I'll try and keep it down to 15 minutes so you'll be able to assess my capacity to assess my staff when I ask them to do the same thing. I guess what one of the things that Peter was just talking about was cultural change. And I think that what we're seeing in our higher education sector is also substantial cultural change. And I would probably argue that we have a demonstrated capacity to change our culture over a period of time. And I guess that one of the things we're trying to do is to change the culture of the context in which we operate, because not everybody is willing, able, or likes the notion that we have changed, because it would stop them telling us what to do. Quite as frequently as they do. But cultural change is important. It's important in the sector. And as I think, in a way, summarising some of what Peter was just saying, it's important in our nation as well. So today what I want to do is to address the need for Australia to make the necessary investments in research capability to underpin our future prosperity and our national wellbeing. Now, the Group of Eight has recently released a policy paper, many pages, and there's a summary of it here which will be out there. So some of the detail that that I could use I will leave to that summary and the policy paper itself. But importantly, I think it's important that I give some sense of scale before I get into the meat of the exercise. And it's important to know where we sit in Australia, because In a sense, you need to know where you are or where you've come from in order to be able to identify reasonably seriously and certainly strategically where you're heading. The Australia's investment in R&D, total R&D, lags world leaders. We spend about 1.8% of GDP presently, and that puts us 15th amongst OECD member countries, for which the average is 2.3%. Were we to get to 2.3%, we would be spending $5 billion more each year than we're currently spending. So some argue, of course, that the amount of R&D spending is not what matters, and they may be right. They would argue, as indeed I would argue and agree with them, that if they were to do that, that what matters most is how well that amount or whatever amount is spent. But I think we would need to accept that all things being equal, we give ourselves a big handicap if the quantum of our R&D input is less than that of our competitors, and the more so if our distribution and usage of the inputs is less than optimal, and I'll touch on those two things as I go through this talk. I think it's important to remember that China spent 1.3% of GDP in 2005 and is aiming for the OECD average in 2020. At the end of 2006, China became the world's second highest investor in R&D, spending some $170 billion, compared with Japan's $160 billion, the European Union totals $290 billion, and the US leads with $410 billion. So they're big numbers, big figures, and Australia increased from $9 billion to $16 billion by 2004-05. So we're presently operating at one-tenth the level of that of China. Now, China comes from a different place from us, a different starting point. We've had a much longer investment than they have, so there's some catch-up in that, of course. But 3 weeks ago, I addressed a graduate school in China that had 30,000 PhD students in that graduate school, run by the Chinese Academy, and they have 30,000 PhD students presently studying for PhDs offshore, 60,000 from those two activities. In Australia, we have 21,000 in the nation. The 90% of R&D growth in Australia was attributable to business business and higher education research and development expenditure, and the business expenditure doubled over the period that I'm talking about. The higher education expenditure on research and development has not quite doubled, but has risen substantially. I think an important point is that for the OECD countries, on average, the business sector accounts for two-thirds of total R&D. In Australia, the business expenditure, the business sector share is just over one-half. And conversely, the higher education sector accounts for 16% of R&D, for the OECD on average, but 27% for Australia. So Australia has, as the government has often said recently, has a major reliance on government expenditures on R&D, by contrast with many of our so-called competitor countries. And, of course, the government has tried to initiate some moves through backing Australia's abilities 1 and 2, and doubtless numbers 3 and 4, which we look forward to with eager anticipation. Will try to redress that balance so that without cutting their share or their quantum, that at least we might get some a bigger increase in the business expenditures. Contextually for us, I think it's important that the Productivity Commission recently reminded all of us in an open report that universities, and I quote, core role remains the provision of teaching and the generation of high-quality, openly disseminated basic research. Now, the debate on that waxes and wanes, as you'd expect, but I can remember being struck by an open letter that the corporate leaders of the United States signed to the American president, arguing that for that then president, not to forget that that their role, the government's role, was to inject the patient capital into research to support the basic research in the American institutions, and they'd get on with the rest of it as the second phase drew off that basic research and began to apply it. Here we haven't got quite the same unmixed message. We get people saying that, you know, basic research is essentially a waste of time, the assumption being, presumably, that we can draw on the knowledge that's generated in other countries and use it as we wish, as we will, as we would, if only we had the PhD graduates in order to be able to extract what we need and apply it to our needs. It doesn't work quite like that. And partly as a consequence, though, in Australia, basic research represented two-thirds of university R&D spending in 1990-91, and by 2004-05, only half of it was directed to basic research. So notwithstanding the exhortations from the Productivity Commission and the assertion, reassertion by them in a much welcomed report about our basic role, we've nevertheless shifted a fair amount of our expenditure away from basic research, and only over 15 years. Now, Australia is pretty much alone in having both business and higher education R&D directed heavily now, currently, to applied research. And I'd put it to you that it's a big risk for a small country, however lucky we might be or we might think we are. The evidence is not yet in to suggest that a low level of self-sufficiency in basic research is smart for Australia, or conversely, that a high level of dependency on applied research is cost-effective. We all hear about stories about commercialisation, and that is indeed increasing as our culture changes, and a lot of the work we do seek to spin off and to join with other organisations to apply and to use for practical, some would say, real-life problems. But what we can't see, and we won't be able to see until it's probably too late, is whether the rundown of our investment in basic research will cause us grief as we go into the future. I think it's worth remembering, too, that the applications of basic research will not be a panacea for the universities. I think it's worth remembering that gross return on licence income was about $23 million in recent years, and we get $900 million from international students and $440 million from contract and consultancies-based research. So the scale is immensely different and divergent and probably getting further apart, and I just ask you whether or not you think that's healthy. I can tell you from my perspective, I don't think it is healthy, but it's an accretion of individual small events where you only see it when you sit back and reflect on how a sector has diverged from its main purpose, which is not to separate itself from industry or the commercial world. It is to work with industry and the commercial world, but not to be so influenced that it changes its basic purpose in the way that we appear to have done. It's also worth remembering that notwithstanding what we sometimes think and read, that the research commercialisation in the leading US universities accounts at best for about 3-5% of their income. And even that 3-5% depends on the occasional winner, and the favourite story I have is the $70 million or so a year US that the University of Florida gets for inventing Gatorade. Well, I reckon if you put colour in the tap water of most Australian cities, you'd have Gatorade, but I don't know that we could run a patent on it and get licence fees of $70 million a year. But it's those sorts of things that generate quite a large return. But the investment, the patient capital that the US corporations were impressing upon the government did not lead to Gatorade. Although you did indeed need to know what the physiology of the muscle cell was to know where the potassium sat in order to get the right level, in order for people to think that it was doing them good when they drank it. So there's that complex of issues, that mixture of issues, which really make the sort of link, the tight link between what we do in our universities and what is used and applied outside our universities with our support and help and cooperation. That tight link is hard to draw. So it's careful not to overhype expectations of immediate profits, but it's really, I think, an issue for us to ensure that the universities don't cut themselves off from the business and commercial world, but at the same time to ensure that we have adequate investment of that patient capital that enables the capability to be built, the personnel to be developed, and the support systems there necessary to make it a place where Australia will not only be lucky, but also will indeed match the rhetoric of being clever. And I do ask you to remember the fact that, as I said, there's one institution in China, or the Academy of Sciences in China, that have a graduate school with 30,000 PhD students in it and 30,000 offshore. And why are they doing that? They're doing that because they're spent on the infrastructure. So if you go into a university with which we have a partnership, or which University of Sydney has a partnership in Beijing or Shanghai, you will see infrastructure will make my eyes water. But what you see is that there aren't people operating them, because they're at ANU, at Sydney, New South Wales, Harvard, Yale, and in the Chinese Academy of Science, now developing up the human infrastructure and talent that will enable that material to be used, so they got a decent return on their investment in basic research. So we argue as a group of eight that if Australia's best universities are not going forward, then Australia will be going backwards against our international competitors. We will be doing so against our international friends in the higher education sector, and the nation will be against other countries. We also argue that we can't afford to spread thinly our scarce resources. We need to build the critical mass of expertise and indeed the infrastructure that is needed to keep pace with the world leaders in research, because of all the things that are certain amongst the things that I've said so far, you can be quite certain that the world leaders are not waiting for us to catch up. They're using us at the moment to develop their own capacity where they presently don't have it. They're doing that in large numbers. I mean, ANU, little university in student number terms, has 900 Chinese students, many of them funded by the Chinese government. They're picking where they believe that they can put students with talent and taking them back to develop up their infrastructure and consequently their capability. Australia is producing 2.3 new doctorates per 100 university graduates, compared with 3.9 in Canada, 10.1 in Switzerland, 11.2 in Germany. So we're not actually building our future capacity. We have age problems within our sector, where the profile from the bulge of the growth in the 60s and 70s is now passing through the sector, and with 21,500 PhD places in our sector presently, it's not enough simply to maintain our own workforce, by contrast with those we export, or when you add to the ones we export overseas and the ones that are used in your sorts of organisations, then there will clearly be a substantial shortfall in capability in that basic fundamental human resource. And you know what we pay them if they do a PhD at the end of a first-class honours degree with a university medal? $20,000 a year for 3.5 years, and none of them are finished inside 3.5 years. It takes four. And so they spend the last 6 months without any income at all, unless they can go and wait on tables or park my car or something like that. So it is, in a sense, the need, again, for a cultural change that I'm talking about. Unless we begin to sort of make career options available and make them look as if they're esteemed by not saying the PhD scholarship is the equivalent of an attic or a garret, and unless you go through severe hardship, you'll never be any good at the end. I mean, very few countries do that anymore. We used to do it to musicians and the like back in the medieval times, but very few countries do it anymore. And Australia seems to think that a young person with all their life in front of them and a lot of talent should, almost as a sense of duty, give away the lures that some of you people doubtless put in front of them and go and do a PhD for $20,000 a year and survive and be happy and be grateful. The group of eight has actually argued that we do need to grow our capability, that we need to recognise the need for capability, and that we need two things to be able to exploit that capability: talented people and classic infrastructure. We don't pay people in the higher education except vice-chancellors very well, but most of my colleagues will not go to another country to prosecute their research if they can have a comfortable living and the infrastructure they need to do the work that they want to do. And unless we actually accept the fact that the infrastructure that you can provide talented people in Australia will lead talented people to leave Australia, then we will lose them. And our already low 2.3 per 100 graduates will, in effective terms, drop. And where is the value of that, in that, to this country of ours? It's short-termism. It's holding us up, in a sense, as a soft target. There are articles in the newspaper today where other organisations are developing their reputation by criticising things that we do. There was no substantive argument in the things in the paper today. It was just that here is a report from this organisation which says universities ought to spy on their students because some of them are foreign. Now, this sort of ridiculous nonsense actually serves no benefit and no purpose at all. And it diverts us from the real fact. How does a country build capability? How does a country use that capability that it's built? And it does it by picking the best, giving them the best, letting them work with the best, with infrastructure that is second to none. And it will take a cultural change to do that, because we have to recognise that it's important. And I would argue that over the last 20 or 25 years, not enough powerful people have argued that it is important. And until we collectively do, then it won't happen, and we know all the reasons why. So, ladies and gentlemen, I'm an optimist, as I said this morning in an interview. For me, every glass is half full, and I'm often disappointed, as a consequence maybe. But the thing that I'm obsessive about is that I cannot understand why it cannot be understood that the future prosperity, the social justice of a society, the security of a society, which is built off economic wealth that's developed in partnership by organisations like many of yours with organisations like many of mine. And if we do that together, we'll beat them all. If we don't do it, or we spike each other. And, you know, I was responding to an interview this morning about organisations telling academics what to do for a little bit of money, getting the result they wanted. I don't know too many academics who'd sell their soul for a few bob. Doubtless there are a few. They're human beings too. Very few. These sorts of issues are divisive and unhelpful, and Australia doesn't need it. Thank you.